everyone, and welcome to Book Solid. It's Soraya here, and today I am joined by a very special guest, the one and only Aaron A. Craig. If you've listened to our show before, you know just how much Indy and I love Aaron's debut novel, House of Salt and Sorrows. It's one of our favorites from the podcast, and just in general, it's one of the best books we've read. And so I'm so excited to have Aaron here today. We'll be chatting about all things spooky, her writing process, and her new novel, Small Favors, which is available today. So Aaron, thank you so much for joining me, and congratulations.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be on here.
And I just, before we start, do you want to tell our listeners a little bit about you, a little bit about what they can expect with Small Favors?
My name is Aaron A. Craig. I am the author of House of Salt and Sorrows and Small Favors, which is out today. I live in West Michigan with my family, my husband and my daughter. And I love writing all things creepy, spooky, macabre, anything uncanny, and that can give you a sense of the shivers. I'm there for it.
I was going to ask too, because I know House of Salt and Sorrows is inspired by 12 Dancing Princesses. Small Favors is inspired by Rumpelstiltskin. What draws you towards like gothic horror and retellings in general?
I think retellings definitely. Before I had my daughter, I was a stage manager, and I did mostly operas, which for the most part, I mean, there are many contemporary opera composers who I very much adore, but for the most part, the bread and butter of opera repertory is, you know, shows that have been done for hundreds of years. And so I think just the nature of being in rehearsal every day with shows that, you know, I might have done, I want to say like 5 or 6 different productions of Rigoletto, which is my favorite. It's so good. I was very lucky to do that many. But it's always a different story that you're telling. Obviously, the music and the lyrics and everything stay the same. But the story and the angle that you're coming at it varies production to production. And so I think when I finally was like, I'm going to do this whole like writing thing, I think it was just kind of a natural slip into retellings because there's stories that, you know, there's something compelling about them that there's a reason, you know, we keep getting drawn to Beauty and the Beast and Cinderella and all the fairy tale retellings and Greek mythology and all of that. There's lots of great little kernels of truth in each of the stories. And I think it's really fun to go through and like find out what is compelling about them in whatever setting that you choose to put them in. And so for me, I love taking like fairy tales and like these really beautiful, pretty dresses and ball gowns and all these things and just turning them dark and creepy and twisted. I've always loved like scary stories. And as a kid, my mom never really liked me reading like the really, really, like I'd always try to like sneak Stephen King home and she'd be like, I don't think this is appropriate for your age. And so when I got to junior high, I think it was in 8th grade, our junior high and our high school, I went to a very, very small high school. But they had the schools were combined into one thing, but there were like different wings for each thing, but we shared a library. So I would sneak off, you know, at lunchtime to the library and check out Stephen King books because my mom didn't know I was checking them out at the library at school. If I did it at our local library, obviously she would know. So that was when I traumatized myself with Salem's Lot far too young in life. And ever since then, I'm drawn to the dark.
It's so funny because I would say prior to House of Salt and Sorrows, I don't think I've ever really read anything that was like horror genre as far as books. And I realized I like that format a lot more in a book form than film or TV. Because I always think I like watching scary movies and I sit there like one eye closed and like barely watching. but something about a book, like it grabs you. And it's genuinely terrifying. Like when I was reading Small Favors, there was a point where I was like, I want to get a snack from the kitchen, but I'm going to turn down my hallway and see the queen's eyes staring at me. Like that was my thought process.
Yay. Oh, I'm the worst. Whenever, like, I haven't been to the movies in years, obviously, with everything going on and my 4-year-old. But whenever we would go, like, I would drag my husband to go see a horror movie. I always have some on, like, not the front row, but, like, the row that, like, in the middle where they have, like, the railings. Because I could put my feet up on the railing and it looked like I was watching the movie the entire time. But when it would get really scary, I would, like, watch my feet and no one would know.
Yes, I'm like, how many times?
So scared.
How many times will I do that to myself? I always think, like, before I go, I'm like, I definitely want to see this. This is absolutely what I want to do. And then I'm there, especially in a movie theater. Oh my gosh, that's. Yeah, I haven't seen a horror movie in theaters in a long time.
They're so much fun to freak yourself out with, though.
They are. They truly are. And so moving into small favors, actually, I had a few questions about some of the characters. So I found the relationship between Ellery and Sam to be really interesting. And my opinion of Sam really shifted a lot as I was reading. Like, sometimes I'm like, is he terrible? Is he going
to? Sam is the worst.
Sam is the worst. Okay, I was going to ask, like, was that intentional? Like, was he supposed to just be, was he supposed to empathize at points with him?
I was very, like, with House of Salt and Sorrows, we've got these girls who are, you know, the 8 of them, I think, to begin with, and then sadly less as we go along, but we've got these 8 sisters who are very much in love, and they, I think, because of all of their shared combined mourning periods and, like, the compounded grief that they've all experienced and gone through, they're a very, very tight-knit group of sisters. It doesn't mean that they don't, you know, bicker over who stole whose hairbrush and whatever, but, like, they're at heart, they're incredibly close. They all love each other very fiercely and would do anything to protect each other. And I know that not all sibling relationships are like that. I'm very lucky. My sister is like that with me. but I know that that's not always the case. And so I really wanted to explore, what that would look like, especially as Sam is Ellery's twin, and to have somebody who should be that close and that wonderful. And, you know, she does say that as they were children, they always were very close, even though they never shared, like, that, you know, kinetic bond that a lot of people assume twins have. And then just to show that, you know, just because you come from a family and you've got all these other siblings, too, that you're close with in different ways, it doesn't always pan out. It doesn't mean you're going to have this great relationship. And some people are just crappy people and you can't always control that.
And so another character I found really interesting was Whitaker, because I didn't trust him, but I found myself wanting to, like, almost right along with Ellery's own feelings. And so how did you kind of strike that balance between charming but deceitful?
That's a good question. For Whitaker, I knew he couldn't say everything he needed to say, but I think he, as a character arc, when he finally came across Ellery in the woods, she made him want to be a person who, you know, didn't have all of the tattoos. And so, like, part of him really does want to share, like, who he is. And he wants to show her. I think that was the draw, the allure for me was, like, he wants to be this person that she sees him as initially. Mm-hmm. He can't quite do it. So it was fun to see, like, how far could, like, if we're going to reference, like, Harry Potter, but, like, if you've got a true spell and you have to say the truth, but you can't. And so, like, where is the tug back and forth between what he can say and what he can't, and, like, how much can he give away who he truly is without actually saying who he truly is?
Right. I am glad the way his journey ended, I will say, because I was so hesitant. I was like, I don't know. I don't know if I can trust you. I want to. You seem great, but I know that there's something. The other shoe's going to drop. Yeah. And so I'm really happy with how his storyline kind of trailed out without giving anything else away. But something I really liked was this, like, how her family, they're beekeepers. And I imagine that there was quite a bit of research, like, on beekeeping for the novel. Did you learn anything, like, really cool or interesting?
So many cool things. Bees are fascinating. Like, I would fully, if I did not have an HOA to deal with, I would totally be keeping bees right now. And also, my husband is not this idea at all, but if they were gone, I would totally be doing beekeeping. My mom actually, when I started doing all the research and everything, and I was telling her all this stuff, she was like, I've always wanted to keep bees. And so she actually did get a hive. And it turns out she's horribly allergic to them.
No.
So she didn't keep the hive for long. But it was fascinating to watch them, like, up close, and, like, they do all these little, like, dances to tell people, or to tell the, you know, members of their hive, like, where the good honey or the good pollen sources are and everything. I think my most, like, fascinating fact of it was that like each bee within the hive has its own duties and responsibilities, and they just somehow, you know, I don't know how bees communicate these things to each other, but somehow they just know that this is what my lot in the hive is. And so there are some bees who are undertakers, and they want to keep a very nice, tidy, neat hive. And if there's any sort, if there's a bee that brings back sickness, or they're very susceptible to like mites, and if they get like any kind of mold on them, they obviously don't want to bring that back into the hive. That'll infect others. The undertaker bees will actually like take out the like dead bees, obviously. Mm-hmm. But then, like, if you're sick,
it's just like gotta go.
We'll take. It's like no, and it's like totally the Monty Python. Like, I'm not dead yet. I'm not. Then they're like, no, get out of the hive, and they take them out and they get them far enough away from the hive where it's not going to, you know, the bodies won't pile up or whatever in front of the hive. They want to keep a very tidy house. But yeah, that's their job in life, is to be the undertaker bee and like to just keep the hive clean. And I thought that was so fascinating that, like, you know, there's these little insects, but they have this very big society. Yeah. Just not going to say the word. But they've got this very structured society. And they just, that's what they do. That's what they know to do. And so they go and perform all these little bee chores and everything. And that was so fascinating to me that, like, that's what they do.
Yeah.
I'm an undertaker bee. Like, oh, okay.
I thought that was really incredible. I thought it was a really interesting part of the storyline to kind of have that be the backdrop for, like, the Downing family. And was it something that came to you while you were writing, or did you go into it knowing, like, you kind of wanted it to be that way?
I knew when I my first like kind of inkling of the idea for the book was it was going to be a Rumpelstiltskin retelling. And I knew because, House is obviously in a made up world, but I based a lot of it off of, kind of Victorian-esque, Europe. I didn't want to go kind of the European feel for this, and I wanted to set it someplace in America. It's very vague, but in my head, it's in a mountain town in Colorado in 1880s. But I didn't want to have like Rumpelstiltskin be like the imp character, because I'm not really a big fan of fairies or imps or anything like that. And so I was like, you know, if I'm going to set it in America, like what monster creature thing could it be? And I started doing all these cryptid research, and I kind of settled between the Dark Watchers of California and Pennsylvania's Mothman. And so I was like, okay, well, I don't really see either of these characters like spinning straw into gold. Like, that doesn't feel very American. So I started thinking of different ways, like what could substitute that. And I got the idea for sugar into honey and bees, you know, spinning, you know, pollen into honey, instead of gold. And so, once that was kind of in my head, I started doing research with the bees and everything. And there was so much of the way that bees structure their hives that it just fits so well with like a town that's isolated in the mountains. I'm like, yes, we all have to band together for the good of the hive. And maybe, you know, so-and-so down the street doesn't want to be the undertaker, but the town needs an undertaker at some point, you know? So like Ellery is their beekeeper. And so everyone kind of banding together for the good of the hive. There's a couple conversations throughout the story with her dad talking about, like, you know, we have to sacrifice ourselves for the good of the community sometimes. And then that shows Ellery's journey through trying to save her siblings and save the town and everything else. I very much saw her as kind of the queen bee doing what she needs to for the good of the hive. So once like I had the idea for the bees, I was like, oh, all of this imagery and everything, it plays so well with like the feelings that I want the book to evoke. So that was a happy accident.
That very much comes through. And it brings me to, so the cover of the book, just so, so, so beautiful.
Same
with with House of Salt and Sorrows as well. I wanted to ask you just, what is your design process like? Like, did you have an idea of what you wanted it to look like beforehand? Or did you kind of give like a designer free rein, like, oh, just is this the theme and you can kind of do what you want?
I got super, super lucky. When I go to start writing a book, I always do like my world building Pinterest boards. And then I have to hide them very quickly so no one sees them and sees how many hundreds of pins I have. But I love doing like novel aesthetics for the thing. And it really just helps to capture the mood and the world and like the feelings and everything that I want the book to feel like. And like whenever I'm writing and in doubt, I always kind of go back to those Pinterest boards and like, okay, this is what you set out to do. Where did you stray? And so I love showing them to my editor and thankfully she likes them too and considers it a part of the writing process. And so when I was showing her all the stuff for House of Salt and Sorrow, she's like, oh, you should use this in when you start, there's, they call it a cover memo. And so you go through and you say like, okay, these are the important characters. These are the important settings. These are any kind of like important like symbols. So like for House, the silver octopus, or the manor, any of that kind of stuff, for small favors, obviously the bees. And then I went through and like made up some aesthetics for the cover artist. And then you do like what, like you use like a series of words to capture like the essence. So it's like sinister, but beautiful, but prairie gothic, but regular gothic, like, all the different stuff. And then they also have a section where you can kind of say like, what you envision the cover to be like. So is it, you know, is it a girl with a pretty dress on? Is it like typography? And I'm a huge font nerd. So I was like, yes, typography, we need this. Lots of pretty letters. And so I had two different cover artists for each of the books. But they, like, I love how beautiful they look together. Like, they complement each other so well that you can very much tell, like, they're standalones. They don't, you know, it's not part of a series or anything. But I love that it's, like, world building and font. Like, I think they're just, they're stunning. And then the, in the hardback editions of both of them, they've got, and papers, and they're just beautiful. Oh my goodness. The small favors one is, was hand-drawn by Casey Moses, who is the cover art designer for it. And it's got honeycomb, there's some bees, there's flowers, and then it's printed on like this cream paper with a little bit of like metallic ink to it. And it's just, it's so dreamy. I want to like rip it out of all the author copies, like wallpaper in my office with it. It's so, so pretty. But I've gotten very, very lucky with covers.
Yeah, I was going to say the attention to detail is what I love so much about it, because like even like for House of Salt and Sorrows, the way it like kind of glistens, like it's wet, like it's just, you can very much tell that it was very well thought out. And it's just nice, like, you're reading something and it's beautiful to look at, it just makes the reading process that much more fun, I
absolutely
think.
Oh, yeah, I've got a stack of books on my nightstand, and, like, I love, like, lining them up and, like, oh, putting all the colors together and stuff. And it's like, you're literally going to, like, change this in 2 weeks when you read all these. Like, why are you doing this? But it's so pretty.
It's so nice to look at in the meantime. Like, I think I think I saw, like, a tweet or a meme the other day about, like, just sitting and admiring your books. Like, someone's like, are you going to read those? And it's like, no, I think I'm just going to watch them and just like
stare at them, just admire them, caress them with my eyes.
So that's interesting. I think I've actually seen on Instagram, sometimes you share like little aesthetic teasers. Your world building for each novel, it's always so vivid. And so I wanted to ask you specifically how you go about doing that. And is it the Pinterest boards that really kind of help you get into that world?
Very much so. I think, and a lot of it, I think, goes back to when I was in theater. When you start out with a new production, especially if it's an opera, you know, that's been done 12,000 times before, well, there's always the big design meetings. I'm like, the designers will show like, this is my inspiration for the costumes. This is what we're looking at for the scenery and everything. And so when I go to start a new novel, it's kind of, I throw myself my own little mini production meeting. Like, okay, this is the world we're looking at. This is what the doors look like in the world. This is what, you know, the churches look like, or this is what the quality of light and air looks like. And like, I find for myself, at least, like I am not interested in the plot necessarily. When I first get the idea, like I'll have like, okay, it's going to be a Rumpelstiltskin retelling, but it's like, where do they live? Like, what does that look like? Because once the world is established for me, like, it's so much easier to, like, stick in characters and, like, plot twists and all those things once I know exactly, like, all right, you walked on Main Street and you can take a right on, you know, Peach Avenue, and then that'll take you to the Gathering House and this and that. And, like, sometimes I'll even do, like, really awfully terribly drawn little maps and everything of the town. Or, like, for House of Salt and Sorrows, I had, like, a little blueprint of Highmore that I had sketched out for each floor of the house. So it was like, okay, well, here's Annalise's bedroom, and then you, Laylee's is down here, and Verity's, you know, like, Elizabeth is on the across the hall, but so-and-so's, you know, above her. And so it just helps me to like fully visualize myself. And so when I'm having to write like the blocking sections of the book where Annalee's running down the hallway, I know exactly which room she's passing because it's that fully fleshed in my head for me. And like the plot might falter, but I know where she is in the house. So that like, that's kind of the big initial like base layer of everything. And so like looking at, Pinterest and like all the aesthetic vibes and everything, it just, it helps capture like obviously the setting and then just kind of also the tone of something. And it's like, is this going to be like scary, beautiful? Is it just beautiful? Is it just scary? Like what does each scene look like? And so I usually try to do like, I always say it's for a celebration. I've hit like 5,000 words. I'll make another one. But usually it's like, okay, we're in a new chapter now. What does this chapter look like? Oh, there's going to be flowers. Okay, we're good.
I love that scary yet beautiful description, because I think you've used that to reference Small Favors a few times. It's just so spot on, because as I'm reading I'm like, man, this is absolutely stunning, but I would be terrified to be here.
Yes.
Simultaneously.
And that's what I loved about House too. It was like, oh my gosh, these gorgeous dresses, oh, you're all gonna die in them, that's so sad.
Tragic, but you look terrible. Great doing it.
It's gonna be the best looking death ever.
So that brings me to more of just your writing process. So have you found that you have like a favorite or least favorite part while you're trying to write a novel?
My least favorite is literally whatever step I'm on at the moment. And then whatever step is coming next is always my favorite. Because I'm like, gosh, if I could just finish drafting this, I could edit it. If I wasn't editing this, I could be drafting something new. Like, why can't I ever be happy where I am? I love the, like, once you have the spark of the idea, I love, like, the world-building process, because it's super fun. I get to look at pretty pictures and, like, daydream a lot. Drafting, I'm usually really happy until I get to about, like, the 40,000 mark, 40,000 words in, and then I'm like, oh my gosh, Erin, why can't you be, like, a short drafter, because you were so wordy and, like, take way too long to describe plot things and all these things. And so usually it's just like ripping out the hair to get to like about the 80,000 word mark. And then once I get to 80,000 words, I'm like, oh, the end is in sight. I'm so close. And then it's good. And then usually I'll kick it over to my agent at that point. And I have a critique partner, Hannah Witten, who she wrote For the Wolf. It's fantastic. I love it. I will sing its praises for the end of time. But she and I will kick back chapters back and forth as we're drafting. So like someone has already seen it before I send it over to my agent, but then she'll read the stuff. And then I usually get an edit letter from her, which varies in length depending on how many times we've done revisions. I think my first one with her, When I first signed with House, it was like 14 pages long, and I just sat and bawled for like 10 minutes. I'm like, this book is terrible. Why did she want to sign it? There's so much work that needs to be done. And I'd been thinking it was, you know, this perfect, flawless masterpiece. And then I'm like, okay, I guess she knows what she's talking about. I should fix all these things. So hopefully she's reading my next one right now, and I'm hoping, I'm like, maybe we can get it to 4 pages. That would be really awesome. Then the edits come, and as soon as I'm in, I like edits a lot, actually, because it's a quick to-do list, and, like, usually, if I haven't written something terrible, usually it's, like, a quick, you know, round of to-do list that's usually about 2 or 3 pages, and it's, like, I like fixing things, especially if it's something that's, like, oh, in chapter one, you really need them to do this, and then, like, trying to, like, thread that through the whole tapestry of the book, I enjoy that part a lot. And then usually around like once the book has been bought and we've revised it and like we're into like copy edits, I hate copy edits. I get really oddly defensive when they're going through. I'm like, I don't think this works. I'm like, no, I'm pretty sure it does. Does in my head. How dare you point out the flaw? And then once copy edits are done, like usually at that point, there's first press pages and stuff that happens after that. But like that's all minor. It's like I totally will bow to your authority on where that comma should go, because I don't know. I'm sure I did mean to say that word instead of that word. I'm going to let you, I'm just going to say yes. And at that point, usually I'm kind of like daydreaming my next thing. So I'm usually in a happy place then.
Okay. And as a self-proclaimed like wordy writer, do you find it hard to kind of to have to edit down or pull things, or is there anything like you really wish could have made it into a final edit?
Oh, so many things. For House, I had this glorious scene. I never could get it. Once so the character of Fisher did not exist until about the fourth or fifth draft. And so when my editor read it, she was like, I think we need like a love triangle. There needs to be another boy somewhere in here. And so I threaded him in. Mm-hmm. And because of that, there I lost a bathroom scene. It was after one of the initial balls. And it was actually before Annalee didn't originally go to any of the balls with her sisters, as she didn't go to any of them until the turtle ball at the very end. And so it was kind of this whole extra mystery of like, well, where are my sisters going and all these things? And like, why are their feet hurting and all these things? And so she has a thing, she wakes up from a nightmare, and the triplets are in their bathroom on the second floor, and they're like soaking their feet in the tub, and Annalee is like, why are you, do your feet hurt? Like, what are you even out doing? Why are you in all this makeup and stuff? And I loved that scene because it was just, it really served no point other than like, oh, we're all commiserating with our sore feet. But, it was such a great sister scene, and I'm sad that didn't ever make it. There was no way to, like, logistically, once all the stuff. But it was a beautiful bathroom, too. Like, it had green tiles and plants and everything. It was so, so pretty. But, yeah, it was, and I think at that point, that was, like, my third bathtub scene in the thing, and I don't know how many bathtub scenes she did in one book, but I like baths.
All the bathroom scenes.
So yeah, that one got cut. And then for the most part, for House, we were trying to keep it under 100,000 words. And I think it ended up at like 102. And then Small Favors, oh, she's chunky. She is 480 pages, I think. And I kept waiting for my editor to be like, Erin, you got to get this under 100,000. Like, no. And she never did. And so I was like, well, maybe I can add in another thing. And then she just kept getting chunkier. And then I was like, every time I go to edit, I'm like, Erin, why have you done this to yourself? Like, you totally brought this on yourself. Wendy did not do this to you. So it's like, when you have a really quick deadline of like, you have a week for copy edits with this gigantically chunky book, then I'm sad at myself. But like, I really think like there's so much of, especially with Small Favors, there's so much at the beginning and like in the middle, where it does kind of feel a little slow. But like as the climax starts to kind of start steamrolling towards its point of no return, all of the stuff that happens in the beginning happened for a reason. And like, you'll start to see everything as everything unravels. Like, there's a reason for it. And so it was hard because like, I used a lot of inspiration from Needful Things. And like Stephen King, I'm looking at my thing and like Needful Things is like this big. Like he's also very wordy. He's usually like this, but like this one's like that on my shelf right now. And so like, I mean, like he also was destroying a town during his thing. And so like it takes a lot of words to destroy a town if you want to care about the characters instead of just, you know, mass chaos. But
I was gonna say, it just shows like the cracks beginning to form slowly but surely. Like, you kind of have to put in that work, because otherwise that big bang at the end, and was it a big bang?
It's like, oh, Uncle Fred died. Well, who's he?
Why do we care, you know? Yeah,
like oh yeah. But like, yeah, Stephen King, he's the master at the characters. Like, the, what is it, I think it's Under the Dome, it starts off with like a beaver or a woodchuck or something, and like woodchuck's doing a thing, and then it dies at the end of the first chapter, and it's like, I cared about that woodchuck. We went on a journey together. Like, why did you do that to me, King?
I was so invested.
I would totally read a book about a woodchuck if Stephen King wrote it.
when you are deciding, like, okay, you know, I'm working on a new project, do you sit down and go, okay, what do I want this to be about? Or does it just kind of come to you and then you start filling in the blanks afterward?
Well, funny you ask. I am actually in a plotting process right now. And this is my first one where I haven't known what I'm going to write next. usually at like the 85% mark of drafting whatever I'm currently drafting, the next idea will get to me because I'm like, I'm so sick of this book. I want it to be done. Like, oh, look at this pretty idea. And I kept waiting, as I just finished up this new draft of a new thing, I kept waiting for that to happen. It never did. So now I'm like reading a bunch of nonfiction to try to get some ideas. Like, I know the feelings and the vibes that I want the book to have, but like an actual plot. And actually, I do have a main character's name. I don't know who she is. I don't know what she's going to do, but I have her name. But that's about it. So I'm trying to like figure out what a good story for this lovely named character is, because like right now I'm just, and I keep trying to remind myself, like I wrote like about a year ago today is when I finished Small Favors. And then I wrote another book in that time period, and I wrote the COVID short mm-hmm. story that was part of the Together Apart anthology. So I'm trying to like remind myself, like, you've been kind of busy, and like there's a pandemic going on, and you've got a 4-year-old that you've been homeschooling. So like I'm trying to give myself some grace and not beat myself up. But it was also very weird to not like be waking up at 5 a.m. with like, okay, we're gonna sit down and we're gonna write. And so I keep waking up at 5 a.m. because muscle memory is a terrible thing, and I just sit in my office and stare at my books and caress them with my eyes. It'll eventually come to me, I hope. But right now, since I don't have any ideas, I'm trying to like as much as you can, and in the middle of a still pandemic with a 4-year-old that's homeschooled and all of these things, trying to like mix up the routine. So I'm reading a bunch of nonfiction, and I'm trying to watch my husband and I love like true crime documentaries, so we've been watching a lot of those and like trying to get an idea for something, and hopefully it will come.
It's funny that you mentioned that you have the name for your main character, because I wanted to ask the sisters in House of Salt and Sorrows, how did you come up with their names? I loved them.
I did not name a single one of them. Annalie, I did. But I originally, the concept for House was going to be a retelling of Annabelle Lee by Edgar Allan Poe. And I've tried and tried and tried to come up with some sort of retelling for that. And there's a reason that he wrote it as a poem and not a book, because there's just not enough of that story for a book. But then when I paired it with 12 Dancing Princesses, suddenly everything kind of gelled and came together for me. But I always wanted to kind of keep that homage back to Poe. And so I actually use most of the sisters are either named after his doomed heroines or different women that he had in his life. So Elizabeth, and Rosalie was one of his cousins. But like even Morella, she was a character, one of the villains in one of his books. I think even up into like Madeline, who was like the captain's wife at some point, she's from Paul the House Usher. And like there's all these like, I didn't actually name any of the girls in there. Thank you, Mr. Poe. And then, except for the Graces, and I ran out of heroines' names, and so I was like, well, it's Victorian England-esque, and they named many of their children after virtues, mm-hmm. so we've got Honor and Mercy and Verity because of that. Sweet Verity. But everything else was all Poe.
I love Verity so much.
She's everything.
Always have a special place in my heart. Would you ever revisit the world of Salton, like from maybe then another sister's perspective, or like a prequel with the older sisters we didn't get to meet?
I would love to do that. That would be so much fun. I definitely, like, Arcania was such a fun place to write. But there's a ton of sisters to explore. And then just like when they're going off to all the balls and like different parts of the kingdom, I've got like these little like glimpses of like what Pelage looks like and what Lua looks like and all these things. It would be so much fun to explore like other places and everything. So it's definitely something I'm interested in, but it would just have to be like the right story. Mm-hmm. And that has not emerged yet.
Would you ever consider doing like a trilogy or a series, or do you prefer like standalone?
I would be interested, I think. I don't know if I could, the duology, I'm not sure if I could, because I am so wordy. If I'm going to do, like, a big plot, I feel like it would have to be, like, a 3-booker. And it would definitely have to be something, like, that was plotted that way and not, like, oh, let's write 2 more, you know, Annalie stories.
Yeah.
Like, there would need to be, like, a full overarching thing. But if the right idea struck, I think that would be really cool to do, just to like be able to live in the world for so long and like get to explore more parts of it. And there's so much more that you can do with like with a retell or with a trilogy, even duologies. Just like there's different like the storytelling is very different. Like you can explore other like minor things and get more like the cast of characters can just get so much more well-rounded than you do with just a single standalone. With Small Favors, especially, like, there's so many people in the town, and I'm like, there were a lot of stories, like, I wanted to explore more, but I was like, okay, it's already almost 500 pages, Aaron, like, wrap it up, come on. No one wants to care about the woodchuck that's gonna, like, eventually die anyway. So, yeah, it would be really fun to do, especially, I think, in the, like, the Arcania setting, just because we know the characters, you know, kind of, all the side ones and everything. I think it could be really fun to do, but it would have to be the right idea to hit for right. sure.
And you can give in to the wordiness.
Yes. Let's talk about this tree for 5 pages. It's a really pretty tree.
I actually have one that I think is kind of funny, because Indy and I, when we did the episode on House of Salt and Sorrows, we had differing opinions, but ooh, outside of writing it, like if you were just reading it and you had to choose, would you be Team Fisher or Team Cassius?
Oh, well, that's difficult, because Fisher is so many things. I think I would be Team Cassius. He was the first, like, he was the first one, and Fisher was kind of an afterthought.
Secondary
into the drafting process. No, I liked Cassius a lot, and he of all my characters in that book changed who they were like so many times. When I first was writing him, God bless Hannah Witten, I had decided I was going to make him winged, because he had to get someplace fast, so he was going to have wings, and Hannah very smartly told me that was a terrible idea. So I'm happy for that. But for a long time, like, he had the non-spoilerly role that he currently embodies. And then for a long time, he didn't know who his mom was, but he knew who his dad was. He didn't know who, he had a lot of identity crises throughout the thing. But I liked, he was all over the place. And then it was so funny, we finally got through, I think it was like the third or fourth revision with my agent. He had his identity, and then my editor read it, and she's like, what if he was, and who he ends up being. And I was like, oh, that's how I had him 2 iterations ago. We've got to redo this again. But it was a lot of cutting and pasting, because we already knew kind of what that version of Cassius looked like. But he always, like, through all of the identity crises and birth parent dilemma, like, he always was that lovely Cassius that he is. Like, his personality stayed the same, and I love him so much. Like, he's Cassius.
So I know that you announced on Instagram that you have a new project, The Gathering Dark. So can you talk a little bit about that? I guess anything you're allowed to say right now.
Yes. So it's The Gathering Dark. It's an anthology of folklore, which is kind of, if you're not familiar with that kind of subgenre of horror, it's like kind of like the Midsummer, nature is trying to kill you in terrible ways. And there's weird, mystic, terrible ways to die. Lots of terribleness. But it's kind of like that creepy urban legend-y bit set in the wilds. I don't really, like, Midsummer's, I think, is a great representation of that. So they're short stories, but it's all YA horror. So, when Tori approached us with the idea for the anthology, putting everything together, she said she wanted to take, like, all of the stories that we knew and feared as children and make them in YA land and like, so much worse. So I originally was, like, I was intrigued by the story of the Green Ribbon. That was, like, one of my childhood nightmare stories that I was always fascinated with. And so I started kind of playing with that and ended up, I went in a different direction entirely. But it's going to be coming out in fall of 2022 with Page Street Publishing. And the list of authors for it is crazy. Hannah Witten's in it, Allison Soft, Tori Bovolino, and Chloe Gong, and just a whole Erica Waters, I'm forgetting some others, but like just a crazy talented bunch of writers telling terrible, horrific things. And I've seen the synopsises for a couple of them. I'm like, I really am jazzed. It's going to be good and spooky and like very, very creepy.
I'm very excited. Yeah, I'm ready to be absolutely terrified. I feel like I've just been introduced to this genre in the last like 2 years, and I love it. Like, I just never thought I would be super, because I, like, you know, I mentioned at the beginning how I feel about scary movies, and I was like, in book form, like, would I be that scary, or would it be like too scary? But I don't know, if it just strikes the perfect balance of like, I'm kind of too scared to sleep with my legs outside of the blanket, but I'm also not like having nightmares.
I love that. Yeah, I that's what I like. I love gothic horror so much because it's so much of your imagination that's fueling the terror, and it's not necessarily like any of like the super gory like torture porn films and stuff. I never fare well with those, but I like the thing that maybe might be in the corner in the dark looking at you, that might be creeping in close. Oh gosh, it really is. Like, that's so much more satisfying for me on a horror level, and like, because it's in your imagination, like in theory you can kind of like, okay, we're going to think about something happy now and kind of push it to the back of your mind. Where with like the, you know, Jack Nicholson running at you with an axe, it's Jack Nicholson running at you with an axe. Like, what are you going to do?
It's very in your face horror.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Definitely. Definitely. Yeah. I had to fall asleep to Gilmore Girls a few nights when I was reading it for sure. I was like, okay, let's try to cleanse the palate a little bit.
I always watch, do Office rewatches. Yeah, watch that's a good one too. Especially creepy. It's like, all right, we're going to watch Dwight now. Dwight will make everything better.
I always like to ask, authors and writers, what advice do you have for aspiring writers?
My biggest piece is something I wish I would have learned like way sooner than I did. I always assumed, because you're a writer, you're sitting down and you're writing a book by yourself, that you're doing it by yourself, and it's a very solitary act. And, you know, for the most part it is, like, you're the one that's, you know, sitting in the chair and getting the words out on the page and everything. But I would say to find somebody who's at that same stage of writer life as you are, and like, make sure that it's someone you're comfortable sharing your work with and everything, and your ideas, and, you know, someone who will also stand up to you and say, Erin, maybe you should not have your love interest have wings. That's a terrible idea. So Hannah Witten was that for me, and we discovered each other. We were waiting for the results of one of those pit contest things for an editing position. And so she put out a call saying, you know, does anyone want to swap stories? I'm into retellings. And I'm like, oh, I'm into retellings too. I have no idea how to do this. And so we like sent each other our books. And I thought for sure I would never hear back from her. She was far too cool to hang out with me. And like, her book was really good. And she's going to hate me. I had this Peter Pan retelling that I was starting to query. And it's now shelved very high on a shelf. But it was just, there was something about it. We clicked, and like, there's so much rejection in writing towards publication. You might not have the right idea. You might not have the right query letter. You might not have the right idea at the right time. And there's a thousand ways that you're going to hear no. And I've got like notebooks, because I'm a masochist. I would write down every rejection that I would get as I was querying. And then I kept them, because why? But they're on my, like, they're in my list of all my House of Salt and Sorrows books. They're hidden in there. Cause it's like, no, that was part of the journey. Like, I don't want to just keep the good parts. Like, remember how long it took you to get there. But to have somebody who's also querying at the same time as you and can be like, oh, I got another query. They had a full, this is heartbreaking. Like, there's so much of writer life that like people who aren't writers don't get. And like, what is querying? What is going on sub? Like all these like weird acronyms and things, to have somebody who understands that and who is also going through the process at the same time, it just makes like the path that you're walking, like, such a friendlier place to be. And you can also, like, especially if you're like me and Hannah, we both were doing fantasy YA at the time. And so we could be like, oh, I hear this agent is really fast with their queries. Oh, shoot, I got rejected in 5 days instead of 10 or whatever. It just makes the process much more enjoyable. And then, like, once you're at the stage where you're both agented and you're both on sub, going through that process together, and then your books come out at the same time, and like Hannah and I have an event next Tuesday where we're both talking about our books, which 4 years ago I would never have imagined that we'd be sharing an event together, but here we are. So it just makes the journey a lot happier to go through.
Mm-hmm. I imagine. Yeah, just like you said, having someone who's at the same place as you and like you can vent to and celebrate with, mm-hmm. you know, with whatever may come. So how did you make your transition? Because I know you said you were a stage manager before. How did you go from stage managing to writing?
I had a child. when I was pregnant with my daughter, I went on maternity. I was at Opera Memphis at the time, and we had a very regulated schedule. It was 9 months on, about 3 months off in the summer. And so I actually didn't plan it that way, but like as the summer months were starting, I was expected to have her. And so I called my last show in like, I think it was like the first week of May or so. And then I went on maternity leave about a month later. And at the time I was like, okay, I'm going to come back, you know, and it's going to be fine in the fall. We'll start rehearsals again. And then I actually had her and realized newborns and like opera, you don't really keep the same schedule at all. And so, my husband, we were in a very fortunate position where I was just going to become a stay at home mom, while tiny Craig was, you know, little, she was baby Craig at that point. And then it was like, well, you can stay at home with her until she goes to like preschool and then, you know, start looking for work again. And so I, that was the plan. And then I realized I don't not do things well. So it was, she would sleep a lot during the day and I would be like, what am I going to, like, am I going to vacuum again and wake her up? Like, no. So, and I am not a very good napper during the day. They always tell you to nap when the baby naps, and that was never me. So, I had been toying around with this Peter Pan story for about almost 10 years before I had started in college, and I was never to the point of like, okay, this is what I'm going to do. It was always just something I was writing for fun for me, and it was never like, I'm going to publish a book. And then I had her and I was like, well, why don't I publish a book? Like maybe, I don't know, it could be good. My sister likes reading it, so someone will. So I started querying that. I think it was the January after she was born. I sent out my first query and 8 days later I got my first rejection. And I was like, oh, J.K. Rowling got 12 rejections. I'm 1/11th of the way there. I'm so close. And so I started querying that. And then I realized quickly, like after getting about 130 rejections, that maybe that was not the story that was going to get me on the path to publication. And I got the idea for what became House. And I ended up going into a pitch contest that fall, Pit Dark. And it was back when Twitter was 180 characters, so I had to do a quick pitch for House, and I ended up getting, it was the craziest day. I had 85 requests from agents to turn in, you know, the whatever their sample, mm-hmm. that they wanted, 3 chapters, 10 pages, whatever. And at the very end of the day, Sarah Landis liked the tweet. And I was like, well, I've never heard of her before. Who is she? And she had been an editor who turned agent. And so I started looking into them and I sent the thing. And about a week later, I got a message saying, hey, I loved the book. I would love to rep you. Can we talk? And I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. And then, of course, tiny Craig woke up. And I was like, oh no, I can't have you scrolling in the background while I'm on this very important call. So I scheduled a time with her and we ended up talking. I got 5 offers rep, but after the conversation I had with her, like, she saw exactly everything that I wanted for the book. And she was one of the few people who, when she said, you know, where do you see this book going? And I said, like, total pie in the sky, like stupid, crazy, whatever. I really want to like go to Comic-Con and sit on a Comic-Con panel and like talk about the book. And mm-hmm. she was like, yeah, I can see that happening. And I was like, yes, you are the agent for me. You can live my crazy dreams. And then in the fall of 2019, I was sitting on a Comic-Con panel at New York talking about the book, which is
amazing.
Insane. with Holly Black and Shonda McGuire and Megan Shepherd and Sarah Holland and just the loveliest bunch of people we could sit and talk about fairy tales with. And I was just like, oh my gosh, Sarah Landis, we did it. Yes.
Did you like have, I mean, prior to like doing stage managing, were you ever interested in writing like full time?
I've always written stuff, but it was always just for me. Or in college, I had a really unfortunate fan fiction thing with some Johnny Depp fan fiction, meet Phantom of the Opera stuff. So there's some boards somewhere out on the internet, I'm sure, that still have my posts somewhere. I should probably delete this at some point. But yeah, so other than my Johnny Depp fan fiction phase, most of the stuff never saw the light of day. It was all, I've got notebooks still in my office because I'm a pack rat, and I've got like some of my first stories in there. Terrible, terrible fan fiction. But it was just always something I just like doing. Like, it's like, oh, I'm sitting still. Like, I'm not a doodler, mm-hmm. but I can write sentences. And so, like, a lot of it is, like, literally just, like, notebooks full of, like, random paragraphs that don't have a plot or anything. It was just something that, like, the words stuck in my head. And so I just wrote them down to get them out of my head. And the Peter Pan one was, like, the first one where I was like, oh, Johnny Depp is not in this. And I should keep writing this. And so I started that, and like it was the first time that was the first book I ever wrote from like beginning to end, and I actually had to type the end on. And it changed a bunch of times, and I hopefully like maybe one day something will come of it, but it's such an oversaturated market for Peter Pan retellings anyway, so probably not. But I did steal some good parts of it out for other stories, so it served its purpose. Yeah.
Thank you so much for taking the time to chat today. I just want to remind everyone Small Favors is available today. And if you want to tell everyone like where and how they can get it.
Sure. So I'm in Grand Rapids, Michigan. My local bookstore is Schuler's Books. And if you go to their site, you can request online a personalized signed copy, and I will come into the store and sign it for you. There's also a Barnes & Noble's special edition with a goldenrod case and black foil ink. And it's so pretty with the little bees on the spine, and it also contains never before seen pictures of my world building journals at the back. So if you're in for something special, check it out at Barnes and Noble's. And it's also available wherever fine books are sold.
The Barnes and Noble one, it's the one I pre-ordered, and I am ecstatic. I've seen like little teasers on your Instagram.
So pretty.
So excited. And where I just mentioned your Instagram, so where can everyone follow you on social media?
On Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram, I am Penchant Four Words, the number four, four words. On TikTok, I just joined. I have no idea what I'm doing, but come watch me flail around. It's Penchant Four, actually spelled out F-O-R, words. Someone else beat me to my other handle. So Penchant Four Words or Penchant Four Words.
And I'll be sure to, I'll link it to in the show notes so you guys can like find it easy access there as well.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you guys so much for hanging out with us today. If you like what you heard and want to stay in the loop, be sure to follow our Instagram and like our Facebook at Book Solid Podcast. You can also check out our Discord server where you can leave suggestions, engage in discussions, and take a deeper dive into our episodes. We'll have the links to all of our social media accounts in our episode show notes.